When I was originally asked to speak at the network this year, the topic first given me was current crises in theology or something like that. And that could be such a scattergun, you could go all over the map, do you see? So eventually in discussion, we nailed it down to three topics that we would consider this year. And last day, yesterday, we briefly considered the new perspective on Paul. And for the next 2 days, tomorrow and the fourth day, we will probe some of the issues related to the use of the Old Testament in the New. But today, we're going to look at this business of postmodernism. Now, you may be as tired as I am of talking about postmodernism. One does feel that this is a horse that has been flogged half to death. Yet, on the other hand, I hope that by laying certain things out the way I hope to do so today, then instead of it merely being a Jeremiad or merely a cultural description, we may get hold of some of the crucial analytic issues that are at stake that will help us as we think through what we should be doing in our own ministries. The term postmodern is not self-evident. It's a bit barbarous. If modern refers to what is contemporary, postmodern, you would think, should refer to what is future. But of course, that's not what happened. The term was first coined in the 19th century and then went out of use. It was coined again in the 1920s, in the 20th century, in the domain of architecture. There was a style of architecture called modern, and then the style changed. Now what do you do? I mean, there's a sense in which every new style that comes along is, in fact, modern. But because the term modern was particularly associated with this style, and then the style changed, then the next term could not be called modern in the sense of mere contemporary, because there was no particular technical term that had been associated with the previous modern. And so as a result, postmodern came to be invented. And then it was applied to other fields of economics and elsewhere. And now, of course, the term is ubiquitous. It is everywhere. The problem is once it becomes attached to almost everything, it is in danger of meaning almost nothing. It is merely a global term of either approval or disapprobation, depending on your point of view. But for our purposes, it seems to me that the heart of the cultural issues connected with the vast range of cultural changes under the rubric of postmodernism focus, in my judgment, on epistemology. I'm certainly not the only one who thinks this. That is a very common assessment, and in my view, it is right. Epistemology, that is the study of how we know things. Now, at the risk of terrible oversimplification, we may distinguish a pre-modern, a modern, and a post-modern approach to epistemology. It is a simplification, but it's still useful. For our purposes, the pre-modern period will run from the Middle Ages through to about the end of the Reformation, approximately 1600. Now, movements in history are messy. They overlap, they're anticipated, and so forth. But for our purposes, we'll run from the end of the Middle Ages through to about 1600. Now, what are the characteristics of pre-modern epistemology? The dominant intellectuals in Europe under pre-modern epistemology thought of human knowledge somewhat along these lines. There is a God who knows everything. We finite human beings may come to learn only some small part of what God knows. In other words, if we know anything, it is by definition going to be a small fraction of what God perfectly knows. If there is a God who knows everything, all human knowledge must necessarily be a subset of that knowledge. So the reservoir of all knowledge is God himself. Human knowing is nothing more than knowing a subset of what God knows. And that means that in some sense or other, all human acquisition of knowledge is the acquiring of what God already knows. To look at it from God's perspective, human knowledge is bound up with revelation. God knows all things, and for us to know any part of what he knows, God must, in some sense, disclose it. He discloses it in the natural order, hence natural philosophy, which came to be called science. He discloses it in Scripture. He discloses it in the church. He discloses it by reason. He discloses it in community. How much he discloses by any particular means, how much he discloses by a dream, or by providence, or by Scripture, well, there the Christians might disagree. Thus, Aquinas and Calvin, though they are both pre-modern in their epistemology, do not agree on exactly how much revelation is disclosed in nature. They disagree. But nevertheless, they are joined deeply by their common understanding that at the end of the day, human knowledge depends, finally, on coming to know what God exhaustively and perfectly knows. And thus the ultimate criterion of what is true knowledge is God himself. Now, that does not mean that we have perfect access to what God knows. That does not solve all the problems. But in the theoretical understanding of how knowledge works, then the ultimate judge, as he is the ultimate judge in every domain, is God himself. Now, many people, again, this is not peculiar to me, many people use the figure of René Descartes as the strategic transition point into modern epistemology. René Descartes was not, as some introductory philosophy books portray him, was not a systematic skeptic. In fact, he was a devout Roman Catholic. But he was discovering that in Europe's universities, there were more and more intellectuals who were self-consciously rejecting pre-modern epistemology because there was a rising number of atheists. If you're an atheist, obviously you can't buy into pre-modern epistemology. That assumes the existence of a knowing God in the first place, do you see? So he was discovering, therefore, that in Europe's universities, and of course in his case he was thinking particularly of l'Université de Paris, Paris University, he was discovering a rising number of intellectuals and no longer shared that pre-modern epistemology. So he was searching for a common foundation, a common ground, a common base on which you could build up structures of knowledge once you've lost the knowledge of God. And out of this, in the early 1600s, he came to his understanding, taught to every first-year philosophy student today in the little Latin slogan, Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. Now, in fact, he was not the first person to have said something like that. St. Augustine, in the 4th century, had said, Si fallor sum, that is, if I err, I am. But Augustine never placed this within the framework of an entire epistemological structure. It did not become revolutionary for Augustine. Almost certainly, in fact, Descartes had read this in Augustine, because in those days everybody read Augustine. It's impossible to imagine that a man as learned as Descartes would not have read it in St. Augustine. On the other hand, he didn't remember it as such. As he articulated it, it was cogito ergo sum, and that is the way it has come down to us. Now, whether or not you think of this as good philosophy, a good foundation, is irrelevant. At this point, I'm merely interested in the historical realities. Now, when he formulated this, it was still another almost 15 years before he came out with his major work, and it was tied, in his thinking, to a certain philosophical structure, which is adopted by almost no one today, and I need not spend any time expounding it. But there is very good evidence, it's not quite irrefutable, but there's very good evidence that after he thought up this wonderful insight, he went to a monastery dedicated to Saint Anne in order to offer special prayers of gratitude to God for giving him the insight, which is not the sort of thing that your average skeptic would do. This was entirely in line, you see, with his devout Catholicism. And from his perspective, he was of the conviction that with this foundation, ultimately, using the philosophical structures that he built, he could almost, as it were, argue people into the kingdom, argue people into a shared knowledge of God, argue people to a shared epistemological structure. Now, with time, modern epistemology, Enlightenment epistemology, virtually an equivalent term, came to be characterized by six features. They are in the outline for you. Number one, modern epistemology begins with I, the finite knower. I think, therefore I am. That is the main difference between modern epistemology and pre-modern epistemology. Structurally, pre-modern epistemology begins with an infinite God knowing everything in the first place. Modern epistemology begins with a finite I. The question is how this finite I knows things. It does not presuppose God. It does not presuppose God knows everything. It does not presuppose a certain kind of God. It just begins with the finite human knower. And if there is an I who is actually thinking about these things, if there is a thinker at all, then there must be the existence of the thinker. If there is thinking, there must be a thinker, if I may put it that way. And that became his basis. But it begins with a finite I. Now, we'll come to the significance of that in due course. Second, it presupposed, in line with pre-modern epistemology, that epistemological certainty is both desirable and attainable. That is, it presupposed that the finite knower could come to know objective truth truly, and that this is a good thing. Number three, it was profoundly foundationalist. That is, it was self-consciously looking for a shared foundation that could be shared thus with others who might disagree in all kinds of philosophical issues or theological issues, worldview issues, racial issues, moral issues, all kinds of things, but nevertheless there would be a shared epistemological structure, a shared foundation. And initially the foundation was, for Descartes, cogito ergo sum. But this came to be an approach that was adopted in every discipline, so that every discipline looks for certain axioms, certain self-evident assumptions that everybody in the guild of that discipline assumes, do you see? And then, once you've got those foundations in place, you develop methods. So it is profoundly methodological in the fourth place. You establish the foundations, then you build your methods, then you turn the crank, and out comes truth. Foundations plus methods, turn the crank, and out comes truth. And that means that all over the Western world, and even today, although it's loosening today for reasons that we'll see in a moment, until very recently, doctoral dissertations in every discipline, whether you're talking about nuclear physics or abstract philosophy, it had to lay out its assumptions and its methods. And if you wrote a dissertation on the exegesis of 2 Esdras, or if you wrote some exploratory mathematical model for string theory in nuclear physics, you had to lay out the things that you were assuming and your methodological approaches and turn the crank, and then you produce your answers at the end. And if, in fact, your answers are judged to be convincing or a true or a net addition to the aggregate of human knowledge, but your methods are flawed, you flunk. In fact, by and large, in Western universities, if your methods are good, but the outcome is poor, that gets you higher marks than if your methods are really atrocious and your outcome is stunning. You see. So this business of appropriate foundations plus controlled methods that all sides agree are in place and appropriately in place at this point, that's part of the approach to Western epistemology, Enlightenment epistemology, modern epistemology. That's number four. Number five, it is assumed under this aegis that truth is objective and universal. In other words, modernists strove for ahistorical universality. That is, a universality of perspective that is distinctly ahistorical. That is to say, the A, of course, is the alpha privative. It is unhistorical. It is not made contingent by history or culture or language or race or any other factor. If you discover in Quito, Ecuador, that a water molecule is made up of two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen, well, lo and behold, the same is true in Chopin, Hungary. Do you see? And if you discover some truth in the domain of ethics or some truth in the domain of microbiology, and you discover it in Moscow, Idaho, it's also true in Moscow, Russia. And it doesn't really matter because, you see, a truth is truth. It's universal. It's objective. And it transcends history, culture, race, language, and so forth. In other words, they strove for ahistorical universality. And ultimately, number six, so this was certainly not true at the beginning, it was certainly not true for René Descartes, and it was not by and large true in Europe of mainline thinkers until about the middle of the 19th century. Increasingly, nevertheless, from about the middle of the 19th century on, there was a rise of philosophical naturalism. That is, that philosophical stance which insists that all that is matter, energy, space, and time. That's it. Full stop. Now, that certainly wasn't so, of course, with Descartes, and it wasn't true of most intellectuals in Europe until the arrival of Darwin. Huxley said, rather shrewdly, that Darwin made atheism intellectually respectable. You see? So there were atheists before that, of course. And many people who were before Darwin were, in fact, not theists anyway, but deists. So the pattern is very complex. This is far from saying that all scientists were Christian in some sort of biblical sense. But nevertheless, there was not the antipathy between Christianity and science, or between Christianity and modern epistemology that gradually became much stronger after 1859 and the publication of The Origin of the Species. Darwin tended to make atheism intellectually respectable. Now, you can see the outworking of this stance in all kinds of ways. Supposing a student graduates from secondary school with very good marks and wants to do a university degree in chemistry at a first-class university in your country. And this student is very impressive with respect to exams and tests and so forth, but in a letter which he sends to the registrar of the university, he says, I should tell you, nevertheless, that I do not believe in the molecular theory of matter. I do not think that the water molecule is made up of two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen. I do not think that the periodic table is correct. It seems to me there's a better explanation, and so on. I mean, it's almost inconceivable that could be said. But supposing somebody did say that sort of thing, would that student get a place at the university, regardless of how good the grades were? Well, of course not. The person would be considered some sort of kook, crackpot. But you see, that's exactly what went on in many Marxist universities with respect to history. Once you assume that Marxist historiography is scientific. Once that's the assumption, the given, just as the periodic table is the given in chemistry. Once that's the given, once that's assumed, then even if you get a student with very, very good marks, who really does methodologically disavow Marxist historiography, what history department's going to take him? And you see, the West has similar sorts of pressures as well, in different ways. And all of this really turns, you see, on the assumption that there are certain axioms, certain self-evident universals, certain foundations that are non-negotiable. They're part of a discipline. And certain methods. Now, with time, your methods change. So let's take biblical studies. The methods of biblical studies may be bound up with classical exegesis and learning Greek and Hebrew and this sort of thing. And then along comes source criticism and tradition criticism, form criticism and redaction criticism. And then eventually you start getting narrative criticism and you get post-structuralism and then you get linguistic theory coming in and so on. And new methods come along all the time. But when those new methods come along, people are not saying all the previous methods are all wrong, it's just that we didn't get them all right. There is more to be said. So the results can be tweaked as new methods come along and are improved and so on. But it takes much more to change the foundations. It takes much more to change the elemental assumptions at the beginning. Did you see? And so people come along and write a dissertation on John's Gospel, and it's a source-critical one. And they're interacting, let's say, with Bultmann's source-critical approach to John's Gospel. Well, the person who did that, of course, was Moody Smith in his Yale published dissertation on the composition of the fourth Gospel, which was an assessment of Bultmann's theory 30 years ago. And then along comes Alan Culpepper. And his anatomy of the fourth Gospel is quite different. It's really along narrative critical lines where he's using narrative critical theory that was actually developed for the 19th century novel. And that's his approach to how he's going to read, you see, the John's Gospel. He has a rather different reading. He's doing a different thing with the text. But he's got a different set of operative controls. And so long as he lays out his methods and everybody understands what the methods are and he's very accurate in describing them and then he's consistent in using them and deploying them, it's considered a good dissertation. Whether you can preach any of it in the church might be another issue. Whether it's tied to historic Christianity is beside the point. The question is whether it's based on accepted foundations and decent controls, methodologically speaking, then you turn the crank and out comes the truth, you see? And today we do this at another level than with the more recent tools that we get. So that's modernist epistemology, and clearly fruitful in many domains. One has to recognize that the glories and strengths, as well as the shames of modern science, really emerge in very large part out of this kind of epistemology. Lest we become too critical and too cynical, let's be quite frank, the glory of a universal truth is surely something we don't want to despise too quickly, do we? So much for a modernist epistemology. Postmodern epistemology, for reasons that we'll come to see in a few moments, postmodern epistemology reverses or revises all six of these characteristics. I think that it's the easiest way to think of postmodern epistemology. It reverses or revises all six of them. Now, once again, it needs to be said that history is messy. It was not the case that you had a kind of pre-modern epistemology and then René Descartes came along and he said, oho, cogito ergo sum, and everybody in Europe became modern. I mean, that's clearly not what happened. There are some pre-moderns amongst us yet, and there are some moderns amongst us, amongst the pre-moderns. I mean, history is messy. And before Descartes comes along, there are lots of antecedents as well, aren't there? There are people who anticipate something, they just don't actually trigger things. Long before Darwin, there were lots of antecedents to Darwinism, too. History is messy, isn't it? So long before postmodernism gained the intellectual ascendancy that it now has in most Western universities, And increasingly in Central and Eastern European universities as well, although it's a long way from having that kind of power and clout yet. It needs to be said that there were antecedents in the Western world. Let me mention a few of them. Immanuel Kant, for example, in Germany, though he was no postmodern, by making his strong distinction between the noumenal world and the phenomenal world, anticipated the direction of a fair bit of Western epistemology. You see, in his distinction, the phenomenal world provides you with many pieces of data that your senses pick up and process, but it is the ordering of the data in your mind that gives a control and an order and a meaning and a structure. And these things do not become imposed on the material merely by the diktat of the material. It belongs to the noumenal world. See? And now, what that ultimately means, of course, is that sooner or later, the meaning of things is controlled finally by the mind in a way that may be abstracted from what is provided by sensory perception. Now, he was no postmodern, but you can understand how his fundamental philosophical distinction between the noumenal and the phenomenal can pave the way along these lines, you see? Or likewise, in that's the German world, but likewise, still in the German world, Friedrich Nietzsche, who really is a rigorous philosophical materialist, and Nietzsche insists there is no meaning that is abstracted from questions of power, and thus no questions of right or wrong, except that which is imposed by power. Well, that means, you see, that the claims of right and wrong and the claims of meaning and significance that many people find have all been relativized and dismissed and finally reduced to what can be overcome by the power of the barrel of a gun. You see? Now, again, he was not a postmodern in any sort of systematic sense, but he had the effect of reducing, minimizing the significance of truth claims and meaning claims and value claims and ethical claims that were broadly understood in the culture. Or, again, in the English world, the romantic period of literature, Wordsworth and Percy Bysshe Shelley and Keats and people like that, fields of dancing daffodils and so on. Real meaning is in beauty, and truth is beauty, and all this sort of thing. Well, again, it's not strictly a postmodern world, but it suddenly means that you're finding truth in concepts and structures of thought that are far less rigorous than foundationalism, methods, turn the crank, objective propositional control, and so on. You see, in some ways, the romantic period of English poetry can be understood as a kind of rebellion against the aridity of a merely scientism approach to epistemology. And in the French world, existentialism in its various forms, of course, culminating with the influence of Jean-Paul Sartre, there was a lovely piece of graffito that was found in the Paris subway in the 60s when, you know, students were rebelling and throwing bombs and things like this. It said, Jean-Paul Sartre, : to do is to be. Albert Camus, to be is to do. Frank Sinatra, do-be-do-be-do. You see, the French have had it in for the Americans for a long time. You've got to understand that. And yet you can see that nevertheless, these fundamental questions of meaning were being debated strongly long before Paul Ricoeur came along or Lacan or Michel Foucault. These questions were in some ways anticipated by the existentialists. And meaning is not found in objective truth. It's found in the case of Sartre, in the decisions you take and what you do. And although there was not the whole postmodern epistemology behind this, yet nevertheless it was heading in that sort of direction, which is one of the reasons why someone like Francis Schaeffer could anticipate the direction in which some things were going in Europe long before they actually flowered after his death in what we today call postmodernism. But at the risk of oversimplification, it seems to me that the three fundamental streams, the most important streams that have gone into postmodernism, postmodern epistemology, are these. One from the German world, one from the French world, and one from the Anglo-American world. Especially in this case, American. The Brits on this front have tended to be more eclectic, picking up a piece here and a piece there. They have not been the leaders on this front, for better or for worse. From the German side came a great deal of study, especially in the first half of the 20th century, in the domain of hermeneutic. At the end of the 19th century, still well nestled within the framework of a modernist epistemology, hermeneutics was understood to be that science and art by which we come to interpret things truly. And in the field of biblical hermeneutics, where most theologians were introduced to it, then they would read books like that of Terry, big fat book called Biblical Hermeneutics in the English-speaking world, and other ones. And in its simplistic form, those books argued that we will give you the tools for a right interpretation of Scripture. You've got to learn Greek and Hebrew, of course, and Aramaic, and you've got to learn some basic grammar, and then you've got to learn different genres of literature, and you've got to learn what parables are and how they work, and you've got to learn what apocalyptic images are, and so on, so on, so on. If you want to see a very good example of this sort of thing, read the first two editions, not the third, which has already changed, the first two editions of Protestant Biblical Interpretation by Ramm, R-A-M-M. And the whole book is made up of these sort of principles, rules, structures. And the assumption really is that if you get those structures right, if you know how to do it, well, then you have the foundation. The Bible is the Word of God. And then you have the tools, the methods, the hermeneutical rules, you see? Then you turn the crank and out comes truth. So you don't need all that much historical theology. I mean, you know how to find the truth yourself from Scripture. Do you see? You learn Greek and Hebrew properly. You learn the interpretive rules properly, and you turn the crank, and out comes the right answer. And that's what hermeneutics largely was. It is still, you see, deeply embedded in the modern epistemology. And again, it's not all wrong. We'll see in due course. You will discover shortly that I do not want to think of myself as either a modernist or a postmodern. I want to say in the gentlest kind of way, a plague on both your houses. But there's some things to be appreciated from both the houses too. But I will be arguing in due course that Christians should not be shanghaied by either worldview. The Germans began to ask the question, in effect, but who is this I who is trying to know things? I think, therefore I am. Look at me. I'm a middle-aged, white, Canadian, male. My education has gone down this track, not that track. Let's face it, I am not a sub-Saharan, black, African, prostitute with AIDS in Mombasa. And that means I don't look at things quite the way she does. Under the principles of the old hermeneutics, there is the text, and I am the knower. And the whole point is that if I ask the right questions and I hit the text, then the text comes back and hits me with the right answer. But now there is recognition that I am not myself a neutral party. The questions I ask, the methods I deploy, they are themselves a function of who I am. And another I might have another set of questions, another set of givens. The I is finite,
And that limitation means that we're never neutral.
So instead of coming at the text directly with a flat, straight-on, controlled, methodological question, it's as if I'm sort of swiping it from a certain kind of angle. And that means that the kinds of things that I can hear the text saying back to me are controlled in part by who I am and my strengths and limitations, my characteristics, and so on. So it's as if there is, instead of a direct answer in, a direct answer back, or a direct question, a direct answer, a controlled given, and the truth coming back, it's now controlled in part by the peculiarities of who I am, and I swipe it, and then it comes back and swipes me back, as it were, you see? And by that swiping me back, I am now myself subtly changed. So that when I approach the text the next time, it's a slightly different me who is approaching the text. And then it comes back to me and swipes me back. So when I come to it the next time, it's a slightly different me again. And now, instead of having a straight line in and out, I've got a hermeneutical circle. It's going round and round and round and round and round. But obviously, if you push that model far enough, you can't ever speak of objective truth if you push that model far enough. I'm not suggesting that all the Germans did. Some did. Some did not. We'll see. Then in the French world, the approach was initially through language and linguistics. The father of modern linguistics, of course, was French, Ferdinand de Saussure. During his life, he published almost nothing. But after his death, his students put together 4 volumes of his notes and published this multi-volume Cours de Linguistique, which became the foundational textbook for all linguistics courses everywhere. It's now displaced, of course, but it was the foundation of modern linguistics. Ferdinand de Saussure. De Saussure was trying to break down all kinds of ontological views of language. What is the connection between the word tree, T-R-E-E, and that plant that is growing outside your bedroom window that is producing apples? Here is the word tree, and there is the ontological. What is the connection? And many philosophers of language up to that point were trying to establish some deep, either etymological or ontological or some other kind of connection. And he wanted to argue, no, it's arbitrary. It's established by difference. The difference between tree and tea and thee and three and Rumpelstiltskin and roller coaster is established, in fact, by usage. And you can see that, surely, he says, when you move from language to language. A tree is an arbre, or it's a baum, or whatever language it is. Did you see? And there's no particular reason except usage and a common function within a language why a tree shouldn't be called a schmuckelblocks. If it were universally accepted within the English language that from henceforth all trees will be called schmuckelblocksen, then that is what we would think of when we heard the word schmuckelblocks. We would think now of what we think by tree. There is nothing deep to the word tree itself. It's established by difference in usage. So when I say tree, I mean something different than if I put in an H and say three. Or if I take out the R, change the E to an A, and have a cup of tea. Or if I leave the E in, so it's T-E-E, but drop the R, and I tee off on a golf course. It's the difference in usage. That's all. Différence. But once you reach the deconstructionists, then the insights of de Saussure in linguistic theory, and he was profoundly right on almost everything he touched, it seems to me, in the area of linguistics himself. Once you reach the deconstructionist, the kinds of things that he was saying about différence with respect to the word or with respect to the idiom, they began to apply to the sentence, the paragraph, and the discourse. So that meaning becomes less and less connected with relationship to extra-textual reality and more connected with subjective différence. The question becomes so important for one particular French expert in deconstruction that he spells différence differently, changes the final E to an A. It becomes a philosophical structure for him. Now, there were other movements, of course. Michel Foucault was very influential. He's a very interesting chap, of course, because he argued very strongly that one of the strongest motivations for the postmoderns in which he finds himself, one of the strongest motivations was the desire to be sexually and morally free. And one of the ways to become sexually and morally free, this is an argument that Dewey presented in the 1930s too, interestingly enough, so did Huxley. And then Michel Foucault says something very similar. He says one of the ways to become sexually and morally free is precisely by insisting there's no meaning and there are no morals. Once you destroy meaning and morals, then of course you are free. And he openly says so. He argues the point at great length. So in university talks, I quote these passages at great length and have a lovely time with them. At least Michel Foucault was honest, not all of the experts in French déconstruction really were. That is the French contribution. The American contribution has tended to come in from the social sciences. That is to say, meaning is often found in the peculiarities of a particular group. One group looks at something one way, another group looks at something another way. The social sciences are interested in various epistemological groups, in various hermeneutical groups, in various interpretative communities. All of these expressions are common. So, Ms. Christian goes off to university, and in her Philosophy 101 course, somewhere along the line, she takes courage in hand. She's a Christian, and she's going to fly her flag. And when it comes to studying Plato or something, she raises her hand, and she starts saying certain things from a Christian perspective. And the philosopher who's teaching this class is very gifted, and he says, I'm so glad you've made your contribution, Ms. Christian. Do you come from a Christian home? Yes, I do. Is that at least part of the reason why you are a Christian? Well, I'm sure that's the case. I mean, you know, my parents loved me and taught me the Bible, and I went to a church, and you know, it's what I've come to believe myself now. But I mean, I'm sure that's a factor. Have you met Ahmed over there, three rows back? Yeah, well, yes, I have. You know that he's a Muslim. Yes. Why do you think he's a Muslim? Well, I suppose he was brought up a Muslim. You know, he's influenced these ways himself, you see. So do you think that he's wrong? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. but on the other hand, he thinks you're wrong. I think Jesus is the truth. And, well, he thinks that Muhammad gave the truth. I mean, and he thinks that not because he studied everything a great deal, but because he was brought up in a Muslim home. And you think what you think because you were brought up in a Christian home. Isn't that basically the reason? Don't you belong to a certain interpretive community, and he belongs to a certain interpretive community? Isn't that the truth? Well, yes, I suspect it is. So what gives you the right to stand in judgment of him? You see, it becomes really a matter of interpretive community. Now, you put all of these things together. That is the subjectivity bound up with the finiteness of the human knower. The subjectivity bound up with the mere functionality of language use. And the fact that we are, in fact, inevitably members of interpretative communities. And at the end of the day, how can you speak any longer of objective truth? You start recognizing the intrinsic subjectivity of all pretensions to human knowledge. Do you not? Now, there were many antecedents to these things, obviously, but they really came to have a kind of increasing control of the intellectual front line of Western universities from about 1970 on. Some earlier in some universities, obviously, in some departments, and a little later in other universities. And it needs to be said that this is not a universal perception. I will come back to the diversities of public perception about what's going on in a few moments, but what I want to do now is to show you how postmodernism, under these pressures, has either revised or overthrown the six controlling characteristics of modernist epistemology. Now, do we need to change a tape there? Yes, I'm getting a warning. All right? So now if you want to stand up and stretch or do a jig or cartwheels down the aisle, and this is the time to do it before... We have about 10 more minutes. No, what time is coffee? 15, is it at half past or a quarter to that we're supposed to have coffee? Half past? Okay. So about 12 minutes to coffee. Hang in there, folks. Hang in there.
Language. Someone has pointed out that dogs bark the same in all countries, but the language
describes it in a different way.
So that's the imposition of
it. Oh, exactly. How you hear it. In fact, we have so many international students at Trinity that when I've had a pile of international students in for an evening, I've sometimes had them go around, you know, and say, what does a dog say in your language? And what does a pig say in your language? And what does an elephant say in your language? And what does a chicken say? And it's outrageously funny.
So there's no absolute.
Yeah, that's right.
One Francis Schaeffer's student mentioned the contribution of Yang.
The contribution of
the Asian people.
Yes, that's it's come in more. Yeah, it's come. That's really come in through the religious front. That's correct. Yes. Okay. Shall we re-begin? If you would mind being seated again. Oh, I see, yes. So let me come then to these six characteristics. Postmodernism, like modernism, does begin with a finite eye, but it draws very different conclusions. Modernism, beginning with a finite eye, was still in the shadow of pre-modern epistemology. So it was still convinced there was objective truth out there that could be known. But now, from the assumption of the finite eye, comes the recognition that because the eye is finite, therefore objectivity is lost. You see, in a pre-modern epistemology, ultimately, objectivity is grounded in God's knowing. But now there is no universal mind. There is no universal knower. There is no omniscient mind. Thus, there is no sure place on which to stand. There is no ultimate criterion. Now, because postmodern epistemology shares with modern epistemology the assumption that the finite human knower is focal, that is why some thinkers refuse to use the term postmodern. They say it's really the same species. It begins with human autonomy, and the only distinction is between early and late modernism. You see, in other words, they argue that postmodernism is merely modernism gone to seed, or modernism working out its own realities. It's modernism coming to terms with itself. So, for example, Harold Netland, and to some extent Tom Oden, and others. Now, these are merely terminological questions, so I don't feel strongly about them one way or the other. And if your definition of modernism and postmodernism turns exclusively on who the knower is, the first knower, then that's a valid point, in which case it's better to think of postmodernism in terms of being a kind of late modernism. I think that's correct. You're still talking about the autonomy of the finite knower. On the other hand, if you think of modernism in terms of something like the list of six controlling characteristics that I've just given you, then the changes are so dramatic, as we'll see, that it seems to me to be better to think of a new era. The implications are pretty strong, and so I still prefer to use the term postmodern, but it's merely a terminological thing. You want to call it Schlackelblucks? I don't care. Then, in the second place, modernism, beginning with the I, insisted that epistemological certainty is both desirable and attainable. Postmodernism says it is neither desirable nor attainable. It's not attainable because there is no sure place on which to stand. There is no fulcrum for your lever. There is no omniscient mind by which to test things. Things are merely constrained by, in the American model, constraints of particular interpretative communities. They are lost in the subjectivity of language. They are lost in the limitations of the finite knower. So epistemological certainty is, in fact, a chimera. It cannot be found. Thus, those who claim epistemological certainty are arrogant, bigoted, and out of date. Moreover, they say, not only is epistemological certainty unattainable, experience shows, they say, it is not even desirable. Because, this is really the contribution of Foucault, all statements are totalizing. That is to say, they impose a kind of worldview, a total structure, which is itself necessarily manipulative. It is therefore much better in the human condition, even if somehow, miraculously, you could get absolute truth. It's not even desirable, because that will prove manipulative and controlling. It's far better to speak of correlative truths, or complementary truths, or truths from different perspectives. The truth for this world, or the truth for that group, or the truth for this interpretive community, or the truth for that religion, or the truth for this stance, or the truth for that stance, the truth for the feminist, the truth for the sub-Saharan black African, the truth for the white North American male, the truth for the whatever. Do you see? And all of these truths together are different slants on things, and this gives us the richness of the human condition. It gives us the richness of diversity. It gives us color and depth, all of which you lose once you start insisting there is simply the truth. Thus, you see, epistemological certainty is neither attainable nor desirable in postmodernism. Postmodern epistemology is profoundly anti-foundational. Because, it is argued, the things that we think are foundations are inevitably the structures of finite human beings. They are not secure. They have not been disclosed by an omniscient mind outside of things and dumped into us so that we can use that as the fulcrum on which to move the world. There is no foundation. And likewise, the so-called methodological controls, number four, are merely the methodological structures that some interpretive community or some finite knower or some research project or some tradition is using. That's all. They have no transcendental objectivity. In fact, they are instruments of coercive subjectivity. If you use different methods, you might come up with different things. So now you look back over the field of biblical studies, and you look at what Bultmann did, and you look at what Moody Smith did, and then you look at what Alan Culpepper did, and then you look at what John Ashton did, and then you look at what, you name it, whatever your favorite commentator or Johannine scholar is, you see. And they're doing different things, and they are reading John's gospel differently, very differently. Now it is argued that because of these different methods, there is no adjudicator. You can assess how good the argument is given the particular methods that are adopted, how self-consistent it is. You cannot adjudicate as to whether or not it is true. It may simply be true, granted these methods, these approaches, this sort of approach to a text. But that's the most that you can say. Which means that in the fifth place, you can no longer speak of striving for a historical universality. That's a chimera. In fact, it's an idol. As for philosophical naturalism, that's very interesting as well. There are certainly many, many, many postmoderns who have adopted philosophical naturalism. But on the other hand, postmodernism, precisely because it is becoming so open to different possibilities for knowing, has in fact in some ways expanded the categories of knowledge to include astrology and insight and third eye, and subjective vision. So a great deal of contemporary fantasy, the X-Men, or science fiction, First Contact, Jodie Foster. See, many of these things presuppose an approach to knowing that goes way outside any possibility of genuine science. An older science fiction tried to work in line with what was understood of physics and tried to extrapolate forward to what physics might become. But some contemporary science fiction is lapping into the domain of fantasy without acknowledging that that's what it's doing, because it is profoundly anti-scientific in any historic sense whatsoever, do you see? And maps into lines connected with the spirit and expanding of consciousness and all kinds of things, you see? So in one sense, this new postmodern world is now open to theories of knowledge and approaches to knowing things and intuitions and subjectivity and astrology and in connection with the universe and expanded consciousness and so on, that is in theory open to far more sources of knowledge, far more ways and means and of acquiring knowledge, except that the knowledge then is not of the ahistorical universal sort. It's not easy to falsify. So now we may speak in almost creedal terms, even of some scientific things. You see, when my wife was desperately ill of cancer, and we thought there was a very good chance she wouldn't make it, I had friends writing and emailing from around the world. You see, and some of them would say, "Have you tried the particular natural remedy of?" And then, you know, it would be filled in, and And then there would be a couple of anecdotes of a couple of people who've taken this and the cancer was miraculously reversed and so on. And then would come the pitch line. You do believe in alternative medicine, don't you? You see, this sounds like a religious thing. You do believe in it, don't you? You see? And so I would reply, I believe in the effectiveness of all approaches to the cure of medicine that have been double-blind tested. And since most of them didn't know what double-blind testing was, that would sort of end the discussion in any case. But you see, otherwise, it is merely anecdotal information. But you see, it's almost a creedal thing, a religious thing. You do believe in it, don't you? So that you're somehow inferior or knocking another position, being critical of another position, if you say that you're a little bit skeptical of all of these alternative medicines. Life is complex, isn't it? And yet there is something about alternative medicine. What about acupuncture? Oh, let's go for coffee. We'll come back and start wrestling with this later. Yes. Pardon? So do you want me to... for how much longer? They're going to knock on the door. The parousia of coffee is imminent. Meanwhile, we are to persevere to the end. All right, we will continue. We will continue rabbiting on here. Let me say again that this domain is extremely complex in several ways. Nor is this merely a Christian concern. There was a very interesting book published in 1995 called Higher Superstition, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, written by Paul Gross and Norman Levitt, L-E-V-I-T-T. Now, Paul Gross and Norman Levitt, one is a physicist and the other is a mathematician, and they are both naturalists. They are both philosophical naturalists. Neither is a Christian. And they are both deeply committed to modernist epistemology. And they are outrageously funny and bitterly denunciatory of postmodern epistemology. They go so far as to argue, in effect, that postmoderns are ruining the universities. And what should happen is all the postmoderns in the arts departments should be kicked out, form their own little universities where they can play their imaginary games with imaginary words about imaginary truths, while the real knowers, namely the scientists, the mathematicians, and the business people, can get on with the real work of knowledge acquisition in real universities while all the other people are playing their silly games. I mean, that's really the thesis of the book. But, I mean, it's a serious book just the same. It's Johns Hopkins University Press, and it works through various domains of thought. By all means, if you want a good laugh on a Sunday afternoon, by all means, read Paul Gross and Norman Levitt. It's far, far, far more denunciatory and bitter than anything, I would say. But it is a reflection of how deeply these debates are going on, you see, in university circles. Moreover, in the domain of science, things are not quite as easy and straightforward as they would say, because philosophers of science likewise, you see, are troubled by these matters. In 1963, the first edition of Thomas Kuhn's book came out, K-U-H-N, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And it's gone through two or three editions. And what he really argues is that science does not progress by acquiring more facts, you know, another fact and then another fact and then another fact. And so it's merely a question of addition. Rather, you get a theory that's operating. And then as you get more hard data, you discover that the theory doesn't work in certain cases, so that eventually you get another theory that replaces it, and you have what he calls a paradigm shift. You shift from one paradigm to another. And as you move to another paradigm, then the old paradigm falls away. So the sensory data actually change the paradigm in due course, but not directly by addition. Rather, you get a lot of things that don't fit until you shift into another paradigm, you see? So you have a whole lot of people with a theory of phlogiston, it eventually gets overthrown by a theory of oxygen. You have Newtonian physics that eventually gets replaced by the new physics, by Einsteinianism. And then, of course, that doesn't work in certain respects, so quantum mechanics is invented. And somebody's got to sort out the mess of the tension between quantum mechanics and relativity theory, because that's never been put together. What we really need is a unified field theory. And now physicists are disagreed as to whether that will ever be achievable, and so on, so on, so on. It's all very complex, you see. But there are whole structures of thought that go way beyond mere facticity, surely. Now, this sort of approach to science, it really has come from the philosophers of science, has generated enormous debate. Thomas Kuhn has been very severely criticized. Not everybody realizes that, but there have been entire volumes of essays critiquing and modifying Kuhn, and Kuhn's third edition is better than his first two editions in this regard. And so when sometimes people who are suspicious of postmodernism give a certain kind of superficial response, they really do misunderstand. They say, oh yes, all these postmodernisms don't want any facts, but they're prepared to fly a Boeing at 7 miles up, and there are a lot of facts there keeping that plane in the air, aren't there? All the laws of aerodynamics and all the theory that's gone into the thrust of those Pratt-Whitney engines and so forth. Do you see? The science does deal with facts, doesn't it? Well, yes. I mean, postmoderns don't think that planes are an illusion. They're not stupid people. But what they are saying is that, nevertheless, the scientific structures that control these things are themselves projections of the human mind, which could, in theory, get overthrown by some new paradigm that comes along later. That's what they argue. Now, of course, people argue back on that one, too. But because of that, 2 or 3 years ago, interestingly enough, sponsored by Cambridge, some Cambridge scientists, there was a major conference in London on science, Christians, and epistemology. And probably about, well, almost everybody there was a scientist. I think I was the exception. I was invited to say something about epistemology because I had published in that area before. And about a third were not Christians, and the two-thirds probably were, because, in fact, those who were organizing the conference were saying that in some ways both scientists and Christians have a certain stake in the possibility of knowing truth. So what are the overlaps of our interests here? That's why I was dragged in, you see. So what are the overlaps of our interests? In fact, the chap who organized it is in fact, at this conference, Dennis Alexander, who's a professor of microbiology or something or other at Cambridge University. And so these areas, you see, are running into other kinds and categories of discussion. This is not something that's being done in a corner. It's remarkably complex. Now, let me open it up for questions at this juncture, because what I want to do next, unless the coffee is long delayed, I want to talk about further correlatives of postmodernism before I start giving a response. In other words, I've tried to tie postmodernism to the domain of epistemology, but there are other developments in the culture that are also at stake here and that feed postmodernism and are themselves fed by postmodernism, and it's worth listing half a dozen of those before we start thinking about the strengths and weaknesses of where we are and what bearing it has for us as theologians and Christians as we start talking about these things. But questions, comments? Coffee is here. So we will come back in due course.